fairly heavy Cuban population. Hemmed in, whatever. I think we, you know, I think we missed the boat by not trying harder. I don't think that the Democrats have a lock on the black vote. I think if a party's going to be a viable, if it's going to be a viable force in a state, there ought to be something there for anybody who, you know, who wants to try it. That's where the Democrats, they haven't made it an exclusive club. I think we tend to do that.
Do you think the president, party organization, leadership is moving in that direction?
I don't know what they're doing the last couple of years. I've really not paid that much attention the last couple of years. I don't think they object to that. I don't see any overt movement in that direction. In fact, I don't see any overt movement, period.
We're told by party leadership, first of all, you've got the candidate that the party chairman is already supporting for governor is a former Democrat.
Right, Jerry Thomas.
And we haven't talked to him, but we've talked to other party officials. They all tell us, you know, one of the main issues in the campaign that they see is going to be busing, which
kind of ask you his attitude towards busing.
Right.
Well, obviously, in any smart political campaign, the candidate is going to use the issues that he can that he feels are emotionally charged enough to, you know, to get people interested in his candidacy. And one of the things which is still on the minds of a lot of people down here is not so much desegregation or integration, whichever term you might like to use, but it is the question of moving children around within the district. For instance, in this city, we have families who can look out their kitchen windows at a brand new elementary school, and watch their first and second and third grade age children walk about two or three blocks to a bus stop and ride 13, 14 miles to Delray Beach, a city to our north, to attend a school that was formerly all black. The question isn't what the school formerly was, because it isn't, I mean, there isn't any, you know, identifiable black school within the school district, but they don't like that kid riding that damn bus and going to another city to be educated when they moved into this city, and they can watch other children from Delray Beach being bused right past their door to fill up the school they can see while mama's washing the breakfast dishes while their kid's on the bus going to some other city school.
Well, the strategy is further explained this way. Look, we know the candidate for governor, the governor can't do a damn thing about it. Hey, but we know that his attitude toward it is that he's in favor, but we're going to cream him on his attitude. That's going to be the campaign.
Well, how many issues that are emotionally charged enough to get people's attention are generally issues that a governor can do anything about? You watch them run on what the president is going to do, or their support of the president, or their non-support of the president, whether they're for the war in Vietnam or against the war in Vietnam, or what they think about the Far East situation, all this stuff, and they have nothing whatsoever to say about it.
Do you think that issue would be to ask you?
Not that issue alone. Not that issue alone. I think that'll get some Democrat votes, yeah.
How do you assess Askew?
He's going to be reelected.
How do you assess him as a governor, Secretary Kirk?
Well, I liked Kirk. I liked the turmoil that he kept going, because I think it's good for state government. On the other hand, every once in a while you need to sit back and take a breather, and Reuben is the perfect guy to take a breather with, because he ain't going to make any waves. He doesn't do any more than he has to do controversial. And he tends to his netting. But the governor in his state is not that powerful. The cabinet system really is what runs state government. The governor can say all he wants about public school education. He doesn't have that much to say about it. The Commissioner of Education administers the education system of the state. The governor sits as one of 7 members of the State Board of Education. The Board of Regents handles our institutions of higher learning. The governor has some input, sure, he can appoint them, but they have 9-year terms on a staggered basis. What can the governor do as far as banking laws in the state are concerned? We have a cabinet officer who is also the chief banking officer in the state. In agriculture, we have a commissioner of agriculture. That's his bag. The governor sits as one of 7 members of the cabinet that maybe make some of these decisions. He's one vote. If he's popular enough that he can generate legislative input for statutory change, fine. But what he can do as the chief executive within the executive branch and the administration of the laws of the state and that office, he doesn't have anything more to say about what's going to happen to public school education in this state than the Commissioner of Agriculture, who also is on the Board of Education, the State Board of Education. So, you know, they're going to get the best hold they can. They're going to use whatever issue they can, whether they can do anything about it or not. I don't think that's peculiar to the gubernatorial race. The guys hang their hats on whatever the emotional issues are, whether they can do anything about it or not. Well, I don't know if I can, but I'm sure going to try, and this is the way I feel.
You going to run again?
No.
For anything?
No.
You going to stay active in the party?
I don't know. Yeah, I'd like to, but I had consented to be chairman for our little candidate selection committee for this county in the coming prior to the primaries, but of course my endorsement of Pettigrew suggested to my local county chairman that I should tender my resignation, which I did, and which I think is correct. I'm not nearly so interested in party politics as I am other things which are going on in the state, which as a private citizen, there are some opportunities for lay service, you know, advisory commissions and this kind of stuff. I'm having fun doing that.
Any regrets about the 10 years you spent in the legislature?
None. It's the greatest experience
I've ever had. Askew gets reelected. Let's presume for a moment that he will. How do you think he would do in the Democratic presidential primary head-to-head against George Wallace and Clark?
George Wallace would clean him up.
Why?
Let me modify that a little bit. I don't know what kind of an image Askew has developed outside the state. And I think that would have an effect even in a presidential primary just in this state. Wallace is on that national tube all the time. He's got all kinds of national type PR. I think even the Florida resident pays attention to that. I didn't seriously consider Reuben Askew to have much of a chance to be governor, so I'm not too good a judge of his potential, but I don't think he has much of a chance as a presidential candidate either, and I could be wrong. I don't think he's that strong. I don't think he's personally that strong a person. I can remember Reuben back when he was in the Senate. I think we're good friends. But I don't think he's that. I don't think he's that heavy. But I don't know. Democrats are—they've got their problems too.
Is he really as straight as everybody alleges?
As far as I know, he is.
What are his weaknesses?
I don't think he's consistently decisive. I think there are a lot of other people who make decisions for him. I think he is, I think he is more, well, I think his positions tend to relate directly to what he thinks the general public wants. I think he has a tendency to be what I call a front running follower. I think he likes to find out where people are going and then gets out in front and tries to lead them there, rather than being willing to fairly regularly take positions to which he might be philosophically committed, regardless of where the end brings him out.
Do you think his tax proposals are a reflection of that, the current one?
Well, if you mean like his corporate income tax?
No. I'm talking about the ad valorem tax and relief of property.
Oh, well.
10 mil to 8 mil.
How can anybody be against a reduction in taxes? My opinion is that if he's going to play that kind of a game, he ought to get really to the heart of it and advocate a repeal of the homestead exemption. And put forward a strong program for support of public school education without using the ad valorem tax as a base. Just wipe it out as it pertains to education. All he's doing is, that's the old carrot routine as far as I'm concerned. We played that millage game back in 1967 where we Republicans advocated a maximum local participation in public schools at 7 mils. And that the difference in what that support would generate within the school system and what the national average was would be contributed by the state, however disproportionate might be from district to district, with an option for a 5 mil referendum in the local school district if they wanted to generate additional dollars. They aren't particularly new proposals. I don't think he's too innovative, quite frankly.
Majority of that relief, though, goes to commercial and business people, doesn't it? Rather than homeowners?
Well, if you limit the amount of mills that a person's going to pay on his real property, I suppose, comparatively speaking, there's just as much relief to the individual property owner. I don't know if there is or not. He might very well be doing this to offset the impact of the corporate income tax, which I opposed. I thought it was a super. I thought he really hopped on a super issue, though. But there again, industry, business, the land developer, they're all bad guys. They're super good whipping boys. I think it takes more guts to defend them sometimes than it does to condemn them.
This may not be a fair question, but I ask you anyway. How do you assess Representative Tillman as the minority leader?
That's not a very fair question.
Can you answer it anyway?
Yeah, he's certainly different than I was. But I was minority leader for 9 years.
How is he different? Is he different philosophically?
I don't think. I think that when he starts to understand in a little bit more depth some of the issues and some of the alternative solutions, I don't think we'll be substantially different. I think that I was.
Does he get the minority to work together as a group?
No, they're not. They're not doing that, and I don't know that he can do it. I don't know that anyone could.
Didn't you do it?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be able to keep him whipped into pretty good shape, but I think the times had something to do with that too. I think the issues are becoming more important than solid party positions, and one of the things that happened to us, I believe, in really the decisive legislative session from our standpoint was 1967. We had the governor in a posture where we could recommend to him that he veto certain measures, and then we could support him. Remember, in that particular year, I had 39 guys and only about 6 members that had any prior legislative experience. So they were easy to weld together. They did, because they didn't know any better. And so a hell of a lot easier to, you know, to run a bunch of sheep, in my opinion, you know, than it is a bunch of bulls. But that session and the confrontations that we had continually when Ralph Turlington was speaker on issues that were related to the governor and on issues that were just there anyhow, I think gave Fred Schultz, the next speaker, and Dick Pettigrew, the following speaker, the opportunity to see that if we were able to reasonably coalesce, we could solve a lot of the problems that were really exercises in debate on the floor and were a lot of fun, but weren't really helping the state too much. The coalescing of those issues and the compromises, if necessary, either in conferences between the Republican-Democrat leadership or in work in committee, where to a great degree some of our more responsible Republicans were able to articulate our position as opposed to theirs on particular pieces of legislation. So a tremendous amount of the issues were resolved before legislation got to the floor. There wasn't really that much to fight about by the time the stuff got to the floor. And I think both Schultz and Pettigrew learned that method of operation was a hell of a lot better than ramrodding a piece of legislation out into full public view and then having us just chop them into pieces. Even though they might pass it by the time they got through with it, a lot of the people weren't too sure whether it was good or bad. So Tillman is operating in a little bit different environment now because of that ability because of the bargaining power that's available to him by virtue of all the other stuff that was done, the staffing and the more representative representation on committees and all that stuff. But I don't think Jim's been too red hot as minority leader so far, but I certainly wasn't either in 64, 65, 66. I think it takes a few years. In fact, that's one of the reasons that I support reelectability of leadership.
In the truth, there was more leadership and creativity and energy and so on both parties in the House rather than in the Senate in those early years of reform.
Yeah. The Senate's a club, and it's still pretty much the leadership in that Senate pretty much cuts and dries the issues by the time they get to the floor. There aren't many votes, or there aren't many outcomes materially altered once a piece of legislation gets to the floor in the Senate. That possibility still exists as a constant threat in the House. The House is a more viable, it's really more rowdy. You know, they're more rowdy.
Is that simply because of the difference in size?
I think size has a... Well, it's easier to run 40 guys than it is 120. The hammer that you can hold over the head of 40, well, you only got to have 21. You don't have to have 61. And so I think the leadership's in a position to better control the smaller group. And I think, by the same token, the larger the group, the more difficult it is to satisfy that number. But I don't think Tillman is necessarily a bad minority leader. I think that some of his troops are letting him down, because what I had organized over a period of time was what we call a little policy committee, where we actually had about seven or eight guys who were fairly representative from the different districts, and we'd meet every morning if there were any issues to be considered. I still don't believe in caucusing any more often than you have to, because you always open a can of worms if you give everybody a chance to throw his input into the caucus. And so I used the means of a policy committee, where that committee, for the most part, was elected to that committee by their several delegations. Decisions could be made quickly, and the word be gotten out without having to go through the full democratic process. You spend a lot of time letting all the troops decide what they think ought to be done to a piece of legislation. You've just got another committee process. So I think we were pretty effective at getting broad policy considerations adopted, and we get our best hold and go. And I think to that extent, I think Tillman has not been successful in developing a sensitive policy committee or liaison between the delegations and the minority positions. But I think he will. You know, this is only his second year as minority leader. Well, third, I guess. His second, 73, 74. And I just don't think you become a particularly good leader overnight. So I'd prefer to give him the benefit of the doubt and see if he can't learn the job. I don't think Terrell Sessoms has been a particularly strong leader either. But I like Terrell.
Is there anything we should have asked you we didn't ask you?
I don't know. You're going to have to probably get on the road by 9:30, I would guess, if you're going to hit Miami at 10:30.
Probably a little earlier than that, yeah. At 9, we've got to do some things before
that. Would you like to run by the office and have a cup of coffee and just...
I think it's horrible.
Well, with that concept, the speaker pretty much obviously controls the rules, and the rules set the designation of committees, and the speaker is solely responsible for the appointment of committee members. I'd rather see a continuity in that leadership and a diffusion of his power. Traveling down a little bit more of the federal road approach, where you can committee on committees or something like that, to select committee chairman and to a good internal administration of the system. And that's where, you know, that's really where my bag is, or where it's sort of developed over the last few years. I'm more committed to seeing the process work than I am as to what issue prevails in a given day. I think that's where the fun is.
Would you have an open-ended speakership, or still a limitation on term for more than one term?
Traditionally, the speaker serves for 2 years.
Right.
One term. And traditionally, the president of the Senate serves for 2 years. Yeah. Oh.
Oh, I thought I didn't know if you were recording or something.
Change it. To making it open-ended and unlimited terms?
Yeah.
Or?
In fact, I would propose that, I would propose to make it very easy for the speaker to be reelected, but I'd also take some of his powers away from him, invest him in a committee of some type, even though he might be, building in certain constraints as far as percentage or adequate representation of both parties is concerned, and even to the election to a committee on committees, if you wanted to call it that. On a representative basis by the Democratic caucus and the Republican caucus to actually appoint members to those committees. I don't like the seniority concept of committee chairmanship, but I don't like the idea that the speaker can, from year to year, just almost willy-nilly change the number of committees. He can designate whatever committees he wants as a practical matter, and with that kind of power, it's always easy to build yourself a couple of, key committees, killer committees, or whatever. And rather than a bill going to a committee of substance, just as a matter of course, with the power the speaker has, he can put that, or the president of the Senate, really, he can put that bill wherever he wants it. I think that's too much power for any one man, even though it's only for one term. And I think that makes it even worse when he knows he's only got 2 years to play that game. He tends also to feather his nest for the future by, I don't mean dishonestly, but by obtaining commitments from the next speaker that the former speaker, will be chairman of the Rules Committee or something like that.
Well, have you found that power has been abused?
Well, yeah, I think it's been abused by every speaker. Insofar as they haven't necessarily been any more fair to the minority than they've had to be under the circumstances. The key committee, for instance, in the House of Representatives is a rules committee. We've never had proportionate representation on that rules committee, even under Pettigrew or Fred Shultz. So to that extent, yeah, I think, you know, I think that a member elected to that legislature, regardless of political party, should be in the position to serve in that office, and with the power the speaker has, he can effectively constrain the effectiveness of your service by what he does to you, the committees he puts you on or doesn't put you on. I don't think that's fair to the system or to the state, but I think we'll get there. Pettigrew supports the reelectable speaker concept, but you know, he's not. And president, but he's not in a position to do much about it now.
You say you're very concerned about the process itself. So yeah. Were you instrumental, along with the rest of them, in reforming the legislative process?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, did you work on the
staffing
and all that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just tremendously. There again, for a totally different reason. Republicans never had any staff. Until we were able to move toward staffing on a more rational basis. The only staff that was available was committee staff, and that committee staff owed its job to the majority party. So any member of the majority party on that particular committee, or the speaker, or whoever, could obtain whatever information he wanted at whatever time he wanted it on any subject he might care to inquire into. And the Republicans just sat on that committee. You could ask for comparative analysis of the appropriations for a gifted child program for the last 10 years of that committee staff. Sometime after the session, they might send you a little memo that they're working on. They weren't at all obligated to give us information. It's still that way on committee to some extent, except the committee staff is more sensitive, I think, to members now than it used to be. But the minority office, is we've beefed that up to the point where I was able with Pettigrew to obtain the kind of staffing that gives me some professional staff at the minority office level. But I think there should be some minority and majority staffing on major committees, appropriations in particular. They haven't gone that far yet. But in the old days, we try to put appropriations acts together to counter whatever the appropriation act that the Democrats might have been pushing, or even portions of that act, we were constrained really to our own catch-as-catch-can abilities to try and figure out what the numbers ought to be. We really didn't have the basic data that we needed, and it was impossible to get. Well, I shouldn't say impossible. Their position always was, you just asked the wrong question. If you'd asked the right question, you could have, but it was always the wrong. We never quite did it the right way, and that's part of the game, I suppose. But that kind of thing directly affects the ability, I think, of that legislature to respond. And I think that type of information should be readily available to any member, regardless of his political party.
What effect is Watergate going to have on the Republican Party in Florida?
I don't think it's going to be too significant in Florida, because I think there's a substantial set-off by what's happening to the Democratic candidate. You have one under indictment that's resigned. You have another one that has been spending a lot of time reading the papers about what the grand jury is inquiring into in his regard, and another that's now in it. So they're 3 out of the 6 Democrat cabinet members have their own problems. I don't think Watergate's going to be too significant in Florida. And the Republican voter in Florida is still, I think, pretty much committed to voting the Republican ticket. Period. Obviously, we'll probably see some flake-offs in Democrats that generally vote for Republicans, but I don't think it's going to be that significant. at least in local elections, legislative and this kind. What's going to happen in the congressional elections, I don't know. But we have an awful, the pockets of Republican support are very loyalist, I think.
When do you think Republicans in Florida will make really serious runs in cabinet offices?
As soon as we, I think as soon as we can develop some potentially good candidates who are willing to go the statewide route. Paula Hawkins, I think, is an example of someone who was able to bust the statewide election situation. And it depends a lot. It's going to, I think, just like anything in politics, it's going to depend a lot on the circumstances. You know, if the Democrat candidate is right, and if the Republican candidate is right, and if the circumstances are right, he can win. But just odds on, day in and day out, the Republicans got to be considered the underdog. I think we're starting to generate from within the legislature some potential for good statewide candidates in the next few years.
Who are they?
Kurt Kaiser is a young House member from Pinellas County that I think has a tremendous amount of potential. In the Senate, there are really several down there. If they were ever decided to go statewide, David McCain from Tampa, John Ware from Pinellas County, in the House, Bob Johnson from Sarasota, Ed Whitson from Pinellas, Tom Gallagher, who was just elected down here from Dade County. I think we've got enough, but it just, you know, I don't know what, Bill James, for example, from here in this county. We've got enough if the guys will get out and do it. There again, most of them don't want to run unless they feel they have a chance of winning. The time that we should have done it, and the reason that I think we had been set back, was in 72. The Kirk fiasco, Kirk Cramer, Carswell, Gurney, that hurt us.
A unified party at that time, if the party had been unified at the top at that time, do you feel that there would have been a chance of some people from the legislature running for statewide office?
Well, yeah, I think even...
Did that deter people like you or people that you mentioned from running for cabinet offices, all that inner messing warfare?
Well, of course, in 70, by the time all that came out, filing was pretty much over, but...
For 72.
In 72? Yeah, I think... Yeah, well, there weren't any statewide offices up in 72. But Tom Slade, for example, who ran for state treasurer and was beaten by Tom O'Malley. I think the political infighting within the Republican Party hurt Tom's chances. He was a Democrat in 1963. He laid out for 2 years, came back as a Republican, ran in Duval County, was elected to the state Senate as a Republican, had a good statewide image, had all, you know, everything that I thought would make him a hell of a viable statewide candidate. And he really got chopped bad. And I think one of the reasons for it was that the Gurney-Cramer thing was so hot that everybody was so busy trying to get even with each other in that one that Tom just happened to be, you know, somebody out there running. And I don't think our state. I don't think I like Tommy Thomas, but I guess I generally preface my remarks with saying I like him, but I don't think he's been too strong a state committee leader. In fact, the last really strong one we had was Bill Murfin. We have a guy sitting down here in Broward County who would make a fantastic state chairman by the name of Gray Boylston. But but I doubt that he'd ever do it. But I'm to the point now where I really enjoy working on issues and as I call it, the process, more than I am interested in partisan politics. I think that's the feeling of the general public today. I think most of them look at the individual and the issue a hell of a lot more closely than they do the candidate. And that could help Republicans. First time in Lord knows how long we elected an independent, Lori Wilson, to the state senate from up Cocoa Beach way. She was a registered Republican county commissioner up there. She changed to independent, ran, and was elected. From the standpoint of political clout, she's not in a position to do too much. She's one independent. There are 39 other members, either Democrat or Republican. She has a rather small group to worry about, I guess. But I think people are really getting turned off of both political parties.
Because this is one thing that has impressed me, is that you did have this very high degree of coalition toward modernization.
Right.
Of modernization of the governmental process itself. Is that basically true?
I think we all tried very hard to avoid mixing our attitudes toward each other on issues with our attitudes toward each other on modernization of the process.
And so you were able to still have strong differences on issues.
Oh, absolutely.
But at the same time, a very high degree of cohesion on modernization. We were able to separate the two.
We really got rolling. We thought we had done it with Turlington. I feel that I was singularly responsible for Turlington's election as Speaker. A fellow by the name of Stone, who was the Speaker designate in 1966, and who would have taken the speakership in 67, was killed in an automobile accident. A fellow by the name of Bob Mann, who's now District Court of Appeals judge over in Tampa, and Ralph Turlington were the two Democrats who were running to succeed Stone, and he had died shortly prior to the session, just a month or two before the session. And I was able to commit all of my Republican votes, because the election of the Speaker, although he's designated by a Democratic caucus, his election takes place on the floor of the House by an open vote by all members of the House. I committed all of the Republican votes to Turlington at a time when he did not have a majority of the Democrat votes, but he had enough votes when added to the Republican votes to give him a majority of the House. And then Bob Mann, the Democrat, conceded, and then, of course, Turlington went in. And Ralph and I just fought all the time. Ralph had a thing about Claude Kirk. And Ralph was a very suspicious person when he was Speaker, and very high-strung and somewhat emotional. I threw him off the rostrum one day crying. I didn't mean to, but he was screwing us. And we got into it pretty heavy. And that's one of the reasons that session went so long. Then I think Schultz and Pettigrew, I think, learned from that experience that, you know, we can get together, we get a hell of a lot more done. Because that's all I preached even with Turlington. You know, we're the minority, we expect to be the minority, but we think that our minority voice should be heard. If you give us the tools to do that, on things we can work together with, we will. And Fred Schultz is really the guy who implemented that. And our agreement with Schultz from the beginning, and then subsequently Pettigrew, was wherever we can agree, we'll agree. Where we can't agree, instead of playing games with us, let's get it out on the floor and get it over with and get back to the important things. I just don't, and those, they're really super people. I don't know if you've talked to Fred yet or not, but they're really super people. And they were able to bring to raise themselves above a specific issue. And we'd hassle an issue. And they'd either win it or lose it, or we'd compromise it. But as to the process, I was worried about my minority not having the tools that they needed to be an effective minority in the state. And I think at that point in time, the Democrat leadership, namely Schultz and Pettigrew, were concerned that with the way the Republicans were moving, might very well be that it wouldn't be too long in the future till they would be in the minority. So there was some incentive to try and construct a system that was fair to both parties. And so, you know, that's, I think, what really, you know, got us moving.
Okay, Reed said in his real agreement with Pettigrew is in the way conflict is resolved, how issues are resolved, rather than the decision itself is how the decision is reached. And interviewed Don Reed, no more transcription, this tape.